Poddo.
The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics.
Hello and welcome to Polling Politics for the latest in our series of events leading up to Super Thursday, as a few people are calling it. Today, we're delighted to be joined by Tony Travers. Now, Tony Travers is from the London School of Economics and is an expert in local government. His latest book is London Boroughs at 50, and he's going to be talking to us about what's going on in London. Hello, Tony.
Hi. Hello, Joe.
Tony, the London mayoral election is what has attracted the most attention, of course, in the previous months. And there's been a lot of discussion about Sadiq Khan and Sean Bailey particularly, along with passing reference to some of the other candidates. But today we're going to discuss about how London relates to the rest of the UK as well, and particularly the relationship between Westminster and City Hall. Going into this election, how would you characterise that relationship in the wake of the COVID pandemic?
Well, on the edge of toxic is what I'd say.
Only on the edge?
Well, I'm trying to be polite here. The thing is that the government and Sadiq Khan have managed to pick fights on a number of issues, some of which, like housing numbers and the London plan, which is a big planning document that the London boroughs have to fit their local plans within. On both those issues, the government's disagreed with Sadiq Khan on a number of key points. But because of the pandemic, Transport for London, which is part of the mayor's responsibilities, has lost at some points, 80 or 90, sometimes actually 95% of its income from fares. That's required a bailout from national government. And the government, for its part, has used this to play politics in many ways by saying that this is all because of Sadiq Khan's inefficiency, when actually they've been bailing out the commuter railways in London 100% without question. On the other hand, Sadiq Khan himself is pretty combative in his dealings with national government. So it hasn't been a peaceful and friendly relationship.
London, as we know from most recent general elections and also previous mayoral elections, is very much a Labour city, at least now. And the polling that we've had throughout the campaign has reflected that. Sadiq Khan has consistently been ahead and never really challenged by Sean Bailey or any of the other candidates. Was there ever a time when there was a possibility of that being different, or were we always destined for that situation? Could the Conservatives have adopted a specific policy or a specific candidate that would have resonated particularly well, or was there something Sadiq Khan could have done that would have undermined his position?
It's interesting. London has become a Labour city in the way that Paris is now a socialist city, used to be a centre-right city, and New York, on and off, has long been a sort of Democrat city. And there is something about big cities, and some elsewhere in the UK, in fact, and their voters, which is different to perhaps the mainstream of voters across the country. But until the late 90s, London was very balanced politically. So what's been going on has been really shifting Labour's way since the late 1990s, making it harder for the Conservatives to win the mayoralty, many boroughs, and so on. Although we know from Boris Johnson's success in 2008 and 2012 that the Conservatives can win the mayoralty with the right candidate, on that occasion with Boris Johnson. So I think on this occasion, in choosing Sean Bailey, who's a well-known figure in London, has been around in London politics and worked at City Hall with Boris Johnson. He was pro-Brexit, which might not have been the best choice for a candidate. It's almost like the reverse of Hartlepool in some ways. Might not have been the best choice for a candidate in those terms. And I think it's fair to say that it's been hard for him to get a sort of breakthrough to match the incumbency benefit that Sadiq Khan has. And of course, Sadiq Khan being the Labour candidate in what is increasingly a Labour city helps him anyway. So I don't think London's unwinnable by the Conservatives, and frankly, for pluralism's sake, it ought to remain competitive, and there are still Conservative boroughs. But I do think we are nearing a point with London where the Conservatives look as if they're giving up on London, and the Labour Party in kind feels it doesn't have to try too hard, and that wouldn't be great for politics or for either party, frankly.
It certainly appears that the money that was potentially available to Sean Bailey for his campaign, his team, was scaled back, or what was promised was not delivered. I assume that's a reflection of the party's acceptance of the situation. But I'm curious then, what do you think success would look like for the Conservatives? Last time around, Zach Goldsmith got 34%. Do you think success means getting more than 34% of first round votes?
I would have thought, well, it's a pretty low bar, but yes, I think that it would be pretty damaging for the Conservatives that they fell back from Zach Goldsmith's position, especially given that nationally the Conservatives are doing rather well, according to the polls, and it looks as if they'll do rather well for a government or a party that's been in power in one shape or another for 11 years. They're going to do quite well, it would appear, across the country. So if they can't do as well as last time in London, that wouldn't be great. And it would sort of play to the story that over time it's becoming harder and harder for Labour to win. And of course, remembering there are London borough elections next year because of the delay of the mayoral election to this year. And you know, the Conservatives would not want to lose one of the several. They only have seven left out of the 32 boroughs in London, 32 that have normal elections. The City of London's elected in a different way. So, you know, they don't want to fall back at the borough level any more than they have. They should be beginning to look for ways of building back in, you know, those Labour boroughs where there are nothing other than Labour councillors now. So, you know, there's a big challenge here for the Conservatives in the capital looking ahead.
You talked about the fact that up until really the late 1990s, London was a more mixed city. What is it that has driven that change in the 21st century towards a more Labour-orientated area?
You know, normally when we're talking about these kind of issues, people like you, people like me will say, well, London's a younger place. There are more younger voters. Younger voters are more likely to vote Labour, and older voters less likely to do so, more likely to vote Conservative. So it's a younger city. It's a city where 35 or 40% of the population are non-white. And although there is some evidence of particularly South Asians in London moving more towards the Conservatives, it's, I think, generally the case that non-white voters have tended to stay with Labour. And then, of course, you know, Brexit, London voted 60-40 for Remain. And that probably isn't going to help the Conservatives either this time, though I'm not sure Brexit is as powerful a driver for Remain voters as for Leave voters. So I think all of those things are an issue. But actually, I now think increasingly, if we look across the country at what's going on in the Midlands and the north of England, where the Conservatives are beginning to do very well against Labour, it appears that there's something, in a sense, going on in London, which is the mirror image or the silhouette of what's going on in many parts of the smaller towns and rural areas of the Midlands and the north of England. And it looks as if the Labour Party risks becoming a purely city party. And that's going to be very hard for them if they are only a big city party looking ahead.
Of course, there's been lots of discussion about levelling up, whatever that means. Well, it seems to mean lots of things to lots of different people. But one of the characteristics of that is the idea of moving things, however you characterise that, away from London to other cities, other areas, different parts of the country, and so on and so forth. In your view, is the government, how would I put it, serious about that? Is that even a realistic proposition, or is it more about how the public perceive the relationship between London and the rest of the country?
Well, again, I think there's a bit of both in it. The perception that London is a gleaming city of glass towers where everybody eats at expensive restaurants, or did every day, has slightly got pushed into the forefront of the way people across the country understand London, even though in reality London has some of the most deprived areas of the United Kingdom. So there's a sort of difference between central London, the city, and Canary Wharf, and the visual images that sends out, and the lives of many of the 9 million people who live in the city. So I think there's an issue there. But as far as levelling up, which I think has come to mean many different things, it's intriguing and I think it's important that Neil O'Brien, the MP, who after all worked for George Osborne when he was Chancellor, has now been brought in by Boris Johnson to give levelling up some meaning. And he's been working with a think tank called Onwards. And I think he does have on these issues, and he does have, I think, a sense of what this means. I think the risk for the Conservatives in all of this is that, you know, given what we're saying about the difficulty for them winning in London, that they're going to get perilously close to giving the impression that they've given up on London, and that wouldn't be great. And the fact is that levelling up could easily become levelling down. We don't know what the impact of the pandemic has been yet fully, but we do know London now has the highest level of unemployment in the UK by some distance. So we're now levelling up to places that have lower unemployment than the places they're being levelled up to. So I think that the government's going to have to proceed with caution on this one to avoid what many Conservatives have always been uncomfortable with, which is being accused of levelling down rather than the more complex and challenging issue of levelling up.
The contest on Thursday is not just about the mayoral election. We also have the election to the GLA, a body that sometimes gets forgotten in all the excitement of the personality-driven mayoral contest. Is there anything we should particularly be looking out for when it comes to the GLA elections?
As you jog my memory, I mean, in addition to the Assembly, there are in London, I think it's around 30 by-elections all saved up for the last year, as there are equivalent numbers in other parts of the country. So we've got a raft of by-elections, which will give us a bit of a clue as to where the boroughs might go in the borough elections next year. But as for the Assembly, well, the Assembly, which oversees and scrutinises the mayor, doesn't have a sort of legislative power as the American model upon which is this system is based would have. So they're more like a sort of select committee of parliament overseeing the mayor. And there are 25 of them, 14 elected to mega constituencies and 11 taken off a party list. I mean, there are some of these constituencies that are marginal. And if, for example, the Conservatives were not to hold West Central, I think that would be seen as not great evidence for what will happen to them in the local elections next year. There are other marginals in South London and South West London. Lib Dems will be hoping to put up a bit of a showing there, perhaps to win a constituency seat. But overall, the Assembly, because of the way it's elected, they don't get huge shifts. But I think that the Conservatives are going to want not to lose vote share compared with last time, and where they didn't do brilliantly, and certainly not to lose a seat. And for Labour, they'll want to consolidate. For the Lib Dems, try to win an extra seat on the Assembly.
Looking beyond the two main parties when it comes to the mayoral contest, we have, as we do at every one of these contests, a number of, varying independent candidates, people like Lawrence Fox and Count Binface. Why do you think those people run for office?
Well, I think it gives them a platform. If we look at the wide array of candidates of various kinds, obviously there are smaller parties, which I'm afraid get squeezed in this kind of election. The Lib Dems, Greens, Women's Equality Party, Christian People's Alliance, and parties like that that stand or have stood in the past. And then it's very attractive, as in the Prime Minister's constituency in a general election, for candidates who want a bit of publicity because, I mean, I think to crowdfund £10,000 for a deposit is perhaps less difficult than it once would have been. And secondly, on this occasion, it was only necessary to get a small number of signatures per borough, a very small number, to, with the deposit, get on the ballot paper. So this has brought forth a raft of candidates. Some, I think, like Lawrence Fox, who are standing to make a point because they have a serious point they're trying to make. UKIP are there, and I think they would see themselves having. And then you've got YouTubers appearing, a new front in politics, actually. And it would be interesting to see how, with their large following, for those that do have a large following, how far that can translate through into votes. And then, of course, Count Binface, formerly known as Lord Buckethead, is one of those candidates, you know, older listeners will remember screaming Lord Such and the Monstyn Raving Loony Party. And of course, it's easy to dismiss these sort of curiosity candidates, if we can call them that, some of them. But of course, occasionally, they will make a point. So, you know, every now and again, one of these smaller parties will do better than a major party, and that tells us something.
It certainly, certainly does. I'm always intrigued by the fact that particularly during mayoral elections, although it happens in other elections as well, but particularly in mayoral elections, you get the candidates promising things or criticising things over which the mayor has no control. This could be the low traffic neighbourhoods that that have been discussed from Sean Bailey's campaign, or all the issues around cannabis that Sadiq Khan has talked about. We know why they do it, to obviously obviously bring attention to those issues and hoping to win votes. But do you think the fact that they're able to do that is a reflection of the lack of understanding around the role of mayor in London? And also more widely then, do you think that regional mayors, however you want to characterise that, have been a success, generally speaking?
Well, I think the thing is, if you're the mayor of a large city region, if you're Sadiq Khan, see what happens on election day, but in London, the mayor, you know, has effectively the legitimacy of a city of 9 million and 5.5 million potential voters. For Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester, a city of nearly 3 million and, you know, 2 million voters, that these are sufficient, a bit like being president of the United States. Whatever your formal powers, you have enormous convening power, the power to trigger debates, to say things that people will listen to get the media's attention. So I think when it comes to things like debates about cannabis or rent controls or local traffic schemes, you know, even if the mayor doesn't have formal powers, they can have a voice. I think, oddly enough, in the London mayoral election this time, the ultra-low emission zone, which is extending to the north and south circulars from the tiny congestion charge zone in central London, may well have an effect. That's a real issue. Sadiq Khan is committed to doing that in October. Other candidates are less enthusiastic. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if that, which is a real issue, does have a perceptible effect on voting.
Finally then, Tony, looking at the whole picture of Super Thursday, come less Super Friday, or more realistically, uninteresting Saturday and largely inconsequential Sunday,
yes,
who do you think will be the happiest of the major parties?
Well, it looks at the moment as if the Conservatives will be the happiest of the major parties. And this is for a reason I alluded to earlier. You know, in various forms, the Conservatives have been in office now since 2010, and Labour hasn't won a general election now for 15 or 16 years, since 2005, 16 years. So in any normal parliament, you'd expect by, you know, we're approaching midterm, it's 18 months since the last election, you'd expect the main opposition party to be motoring in terms of winning seats in local elections. I know they're local elections, and I'm the biggest supporter of them being seen as local elections. However, they do pick up elements of a sort of major opinion poll as well in midterm. And frankly, Labour and the Lib Dems against the Conservatives ought to be doing really well by this point in Parliament and when the Conservatives have in various forms been in power for so long. And it doesn't look as if they're going to do particularly well. It's true, Labour may win some seats here and there. The Conservatives probably will also win seats here and there. The Lib Dems may not win that many. And I think that comes out better for the Conservatives. It's remarkable. The Conservatives still have the largest number of councillors of any party after 11 years of effectively being in government. And that's not happened before. So I can't see this other than being good for the Conservatives and rather less good for Labour and the Liberal Democrats. We'll leave the SNP to one side. That's a big, separate, different issue.
A big thank you to Tony Travers. Tony, which is your favourite London borough?
Well, I'd have to say the one I lived in. I mean, I live in, which is Camden, but it's an invidious choice because I wrote a book about them, as you kindly mentioned earlier on. And against that backdrop, one of the things I've done during the lockdown, actually, as the rules have changed, is to walk through them all and on long walks to, and you know, they are fascinating places all, each with their own character. So, you know, I'd have to be kindly to the borough I've lived in for many years, lived in Westminster before that, that was fine. So they're all wonderful.
Thank you. The correct answer was Barnet.
I bet you lived there then.
Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled P-O-D-O-T-P-O-D-S.com.